And we are back. Thanks for joining us again this week for another episode of IndyCar Weekly. My name is Nathan Brown. I'm the Motorsports Insider for USA Today and the Indianapolis Star, joined as always by my co-host Jack Harvey, the driver of the number 60 Meyer-Shank Racing Honda. And we've got another great episode for you guys this week where we will break down the Grand Prix of Portland and the mess that happened in the first of 1,300 turns on Sunday. We've got another race to preview at WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca, taking place on Sunday, a championship battle that has heated up even more with just two races to go. Some great questions for you from you guys as well that we will tackle here with Jack in a second. But first thing I want to know, Jack, is fantasy football week one. How did your team fare?
I played Aaron Rodgers. and had Tonyan as my tight end. And between them in our league, they got a combined of 2 points. So it kind of stings because the rest of my team actually did pretty well, which I guess you can see where I'm going with this. I did not win. I lost by about 15 points, I guess.
Oh, and no.
I played against Russell Wilson, who had an absolute day with the Colts secondary, it would appear. So, yes, I finished the race. I was like, yeah, this is great. And then I checked my fantasy team and then just was like, oh, no. Like, what happened to Rodgers?
Yes, so Go ahead.
I was a lot miffed, if I'm honest with you.
I had Aaron Rodgers as well, and that surprising or unsurprisingly did not go very well. He had 1 point. As I'm looking down the list, I had Amari Cooper was my highlight of.
Oh, there you go.
And that happened on Thursday night of all times. So Sunday, actually, fantasy football wise, not very strong for me.
Did you win?
Went in with like a 15 point projected points advantage and lost by 30. So.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're in the same. But I actually got quite a good feeling about my team in like a global way. Cooper Kupp did pretty well. You know, I think. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand why the Rams gave up so much to get Stafford.
Yeah.
The time. Mm-hmm. And then actually watching him play at the weekend, just kind of one of them ones you're like, oh, I guess that's why they did it.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
So,
It was interesting. I spent about 3 years out here on the West Coast before I eventually wound my way back to Indiana and took the job at the Indianapolis Star covering IndyCar. But before that, spending 3 years out on the West Coast where football on Sunday is quite literally your whole day, I have to say really enjoyed it. Certainly didn't get, you know, quite the same viewpoint because we had a race to cover on Sunday at Portland International Raceway, but it was nice to have football on the radar kind of throughout the day, sitting in the press box, maybe watching a little bit before things got going on Sunday morning. But man, what a race did we have to cover on Sunday. Played out at least in terms of lap one, I think, in the way lots of folks expected, and really had a pretty big hand in determining Sunday's eventual winner. Alex Palou won his third race of the year. No driver has won more this season. He retakes the championship lead over Pato O'Ward. He's got a 25-point gap on second place with just two races to go. Alexander Rossi finishes second, his best finish of the year, his first podium of the year. Was really hunting down Alex pretty close there toward the end, just maybe didn't quite have the time or maybe quite the speed and in maybe the proper passing zone to find a place to make a move on Pillow to get his first win in a couple of years now. And Scott Dixon slots into third, same place he started the race. Really the same place. We had the the same 1 through 3 on the starting grid as we did on the podium, but it certainly took quite a lot of moving and shaking to get them back in that position, and followed closely after that by my co-host Jack Harvey in fourth place, his tied for his best race finish of the year. Jack, I know you said you came away feeling like a pretty good race there. Maybe kind of we'll certainly get into some of the bigger picture items on how this race played out, but can you kind of just take us through very briefly to start about reactions to finally getting a race that really felt like just about completely fell into place for you guys from start to finish?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, it was a really good day for us. Qualifying was definitely a mystery. We had a ton of pace in the warm-up and in practice, and then actually the race itself. But quali was weird, and definitely gained a bunch of spots at the start. The IndyCar were extremely clear on what they were going to do, if people had to go down the escape road and whatnot. And our plan was to stay on track at pretty much all costs, which ended up working out pretty well. And then after that, we had really great pace. Our strategy worked pretty well, and it's just one of them times where you come back after, chatting with the team a bit and things like that, and like, why don't we just do that more often? So overall, it was really, really strong day for us, especially from where we started. So, if we could just keep that up, then I think things will continue to play out in a good way.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you and Elio finished second and third in the lone major practice session that we had on Saturday morning, and then took us a little bit of a step back there in qualifying. I don't remember exactly what position you started the race, but I think if it was
20th.
Outside, it was 20th. Yeah, that's right. That's what I thought I had in my head. And he was right there around you. That put you guys, I know, in a position you don't necessarily want to be heading into turn one, lap one at Portland International Raceway. Is there a tougher, maybe more nerve-wracking starting turn on the IndyCar schedule than that turn at Portland for you guys?
I don't think so. We've seen Portland last few times that we've been back there be, so difficult to race at. Turn one is, pretty difficult. There's no doubt about it. Been on, maybe not, I've always actually got through turn one okay, but, certainly it's an extremely difficult turn, for everyone to try and navigate on starts, restarts, and, especially with IndyCar now saying as well that they were going to really monitor it and make sure that people weren't using the escape path, honestly, almost in any circumstance, really. At the start, I thought, Alex Palou got pretty hurt by all of that because he was, obviously had the lead, and, it looked like maybe Felix just caught Scott, which shoved Scott into, the inside of him, and, certainly, nearly turned the race upside down. And I thought that, that one of them yellows kind of balanced the race out again on strategy-wise, I would say. But it's just wild, I think you're arriving at that corner so fast, and it's a 90 degree, first gear right hander, so it's a really tough one. I don't know what you could do to avoid it. I think if you did the back straight as the start line, then suddenly turns 10, 11, and 12 would be chaos. I think, I don't know what the solution to that is. In all fairness, it's just a tough one for everyone to navigate, I think.
I just don't know what Alex is supposed to do there. So we're they start. Alex Pillow is obviously on the inside. Dixon jumps inside of him, even still, he later said he was taking that inside line to kind of prevent anyone from, say, like, you know, the third, fourth row, I think, from trying to just dive in there that could potentially cause some issues. And in talking to Scott after the race, what sounds like happened is, I think Felix just barely gave him a little tap from behind there, talking about Dixon. And at that point, at that speed, you know, like you're saying, you just lose all sort of braking control, the type of braking that you certainly need to be able to make to go from whatever high speed you guys are taking through that front straight into turn one to make a 90 degree first gear turn. And he basically just decided ahead of time he's not going to make it. And rather than attempt to try and make a turn that he's pretty confident as a 20-year veteran he's not going to make, to just dive straight through it. And luckily, both Pillow and Rossi realized that as well and didn't try to make the turn. I mean, that could have taken out a large chunk of the field and certainly probably those top three guys for the whole race. They dive through the infield portion. They take the temporary chicane that IndyCar had told folks to take. But I mean, Alex, basically in trying to avoid taking out a large portion of the field and ending his day through no fault of his own, drops from first in the race to 16th. By the time that we got to the next restart and IndyCar had reordered the field. I don't really know what else you're supposed to do there. I guess he opted to save his day, but certainly paid a big price in the process. And certainly, you know, I didn't imagine at that point that he would be able to climb back up into the heat of the race and certainly end up winning it as he was able to. But quite a.
I mean, he was fast. You could see how quick he was straight away. And sure. I actually agree with you. I don't know what the best solution to that is, because if people are like, well, you know, it should be, you know, if you had to use it, then it's incredibly subjective. And I think IndyCar this weekend wanted to come there with something actually that wasn't subjective, but was clear. And it just, in that moment, it hurt him a lot. And that was nothing to do with anything that he had done. So I don't know what the best solution to that is, because if you open it up to, well, did he have to avoid that? You know, should have this, should have that. I mean, that's a slippery slope then for some people, probably, to feel that they think that they should have been allowed to do it, etc. Mm-hmm. And then they didn't do it, you know, and things like that. So, yeah, it's an incredibly tough one, mate, honestly. Like, I don't know what I think the right solution to that actually is. It's just it's a difficult one, and it's moments like that I don't envy, you know, Kyle Novak's job.
No, not one bit. I mean, you would think I think hindsight is always 20/20, but I would assume that you would be able to look at instances of guys having to dive straight through turn one and take the temporary chicane and identify times where someone like the top four guys did on lap one on Sunday, where that was an instance where obviously there was a mistake that was made. Felix made contact with the back of Scott. But those four drivers certainly did not try to do that and take advantage of anything by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, I think Alex came out of that maybe in like fifth or sixth, and the other guys, you know, followed behind him after that. So that is certainly not something that he did to take advantage and, you know, try to get even more of a gap on the rest of the field. I would hope
it was avoidable contact, right?
Yeah, well, but I mean, saying very, very blankly, I don't even know that Felix got a penalty for that. I'd have to go back and look and see.
But the crazy thing is, though, you watch it. I mean, it was the most minuscule of nudges.
It was. It was very small. Know? And that's probably why, if he didn't get a penalty, why they opted not to do that. Because it was very small. But Scott was telling me after the race, he just felt like he lost all breaking capability in trying to make that corner. Maybe he was being extra cautious. I don't know. But yeah, you wonder.
Well, I wonder if they'd
be able to look at that moving forward and maybe have some sort of a, I know anytime you take things away from being black and white, you run into potential issues, but I just maybe hope that down the line that you'd kind of know in your head that if something like that happens on lap one, that it's probably not guys trying to take advantage of a rule. And if you see someone mid pack, you know, mid race, just dive straight through there and you know, maybe if they gain a couple spots or get even close to gaining a couple spots, that's when you, you know, enforce the borders of the track. But I know.
I don't know. I mean, I completely understand when you were saying that Scott covered the line to try and prevent people doing that. You know, from what I saw, Romain was never going to make the corner, you know, without touching people and going straight through. So, you know, in corners like that, I mean, really, it's I actually prefer that IndyCar made a clear statement on it. And they went, no, if you have to go through, this is a penalty, sorry. You know, because then it's down to, like, respect between drivers, I think.
That's true.
The other thing that also should be monitored is if you can't go down the escape road, you shouldn't be able to cut the curb on the inside of turn one and be right at the wall. And I saw a couple of people do that, and that wasn't a penalty.
There was. Right.
You know, so to me, that I would say, look, like, you... we are defining the track as this, and the track was defined, you know, by not being on the inside of the curb in turn one, having to hit both beacons and not going through the runoff at the start. But it also has to apply, as I mean, because bear in mind, I started ahead of Romain, and actually where you see where he almost got to in braking, I mean, he was nearly mid-pack.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a huge maneuver for people to try and get through. And the problem is, in that particular corner, is, you know, the ideal racing line is as far drivers left as you can get. Into the start, you pretty much have to cover the whole inside, because it's so inviting, you know, for drivers to make a maneuver at. And also, I don't think Portland, in terms of a race, you know, overtaking is pretty limited, I would say, which also is what then drives that desire for people to make progress at the start. You know, an hour before the race, you know, I chatted about it with the team, and they were like, if you have to stop on track, like, and you can, you know, safely stop on track and wait for the carnage to move, and people have had to go through the runoff, you will get all them spots back.
Sure.
You know, so our plan was at all costs do that, you know, and I think it sucks that it happened for some people, but it also, at some point, don't you have to put that on the drivers to go, no one wants to get these penalties, so let's be hard but fair, maybe. Because in the same breath, like, there's always a catalyst to a crash like that, and I don't know if I saw anyone get penalized for actual something at the start.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think, and I, you know, now that you say it a little bit more, I mean, I think we also do get frustrated with IndyCar from, you know, whether that's a driver or media or fan perspective, when they make subjective calls that we don't necessarily agree with. So I guess I will say, as much as it, you know, it was certainly tough when you look at, you know, someone like Scott or Rossi or Pillow that did nothing really wrong from what it looks like and had to pay a penalty. Obviously, they were able to work back and got right back up there, and it didn't necessarily hurt them in the long run. But I will applaud, you know, IndyCar for taking as much subjectivity out of it as possible, because obviously that is where you get into issues that you can really point to and say, why didn't you do this? From what I had heard, and you certainly back this up, they made it very clear about what this was going to be like in the driver's meeting. And I guess in some way, maybe it comes down to Felix in some way. You just have to maybe, especially when you're at the front of the race like that, to just be not quite as aggressive and just make sure that you don't run into the back of someone, because that certainly caused a good amount of chaos. You brought up Romain. He let me in on something after the race that I applaud him for admitting to. Apparently, his the reason that he had such a far breaking point and turned into what I think your teammate Elio called a torpedo there, lap one, turn one, was because he forgot that he was not in Europe, he was not in Formula One, and that braking boards were not marked by meters, they were marked by feet. And so when he saw the 300, he was thinking in his head about 300 meters, which is about 1,000 feet instead of 300 feet. And I think it's probably the first time he's made that mistake. And just, I guess maybe that's what happens when you spend 10 years in Formula One and just had what we would call a brain fart. And that's why he was, could be seen on the footage, just kind of darting through the field there. Certainly was something it sounded like he didn't do on purpose, but I know he took.
I think everyone would say that, you know, definitely wasn't on purpose. I mean, he, you know, hurt his own race by doing that. And same with Felix, really. I mean, no one ever is intentionally going out there to do anything bad at the start.
Mm-hmm.
If that's what Romain said, then, you know, I've no reason to doubt it. And I also think that when you're starting that far back, you know, sometimes your vision is skewed. You know, people are checking up and you're not entirely sure what the checkup's for. I feel like he's maybe done enough races this year to, I don't know. If you'd have said that to me straight after the race, I'd have probably questioned it a little bit, especially if I'd have been taken out in it. Luckily, he managed to get through it. But people laugh and joke, but I mean, there are definitely some subtleness, tiny details that, you know, is hard actually coming from Europe and coming to America. You know, a lot of things we do, you know, obviously is on metric, you know, instead of imperial measurements. And, mm-hmm. you know, those things do occasionally take a second to get used to.
Yeah, he said, you know, there had been enough, I don't know if it was dust or marbles or whatever it was that might have gotten just lifted just heading into the start of the race. He couldn't see a whole lot in front of him to know, like, you know, okay, this is where everyone's braking. I need to be doing that too. And I think just for the, you know, the split second that it takes to forget which continent you're driving in, which series you're driving in, certainly that's all it takes to screw that up. I'll at least take him at his word. He's run a pretty clean season and certainly not what we would expect out of him. And he did seem fairly apologetic coming out of that. But we had quite a good amount of racing that came after that. You got through there cleanly. Take us through, I think we will have a question on this from our fans that put in questions, but I'll just go ahead and ask this. Now, when you guys had started the race, you guys were the first that finished on the two-stop strategy. Was that the play heading into the race on Sunday, or is that something that you guys altered to because of the 10 laps that were ran under caution to kick things off?
That was our play, actually.
Okay.
You know, from where we were starting, we felt like, you know, three stop, you know, we felt like we were going to have pace, you know, and that wasn't a super concern heading into the race. You know, our concern was how far forward can you get on the same strategy as everybody else?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in that moment, we made the decision to, before the race, to do the two stop. Once we got through the melee, you know, I think I keyed up the radio and said, please let's stay on the two stop. You know, because I felt like we were quicker than the cars ahead of us, directly ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
And on that particular day, it worked very nicely. You know, I think starting 20 and finishing fourth was a great result. And, you know, I think probably someone else who feels a bit hard done by in the race is probably Graham. You know, I think he did have a bit of a cushion, you know, over everybody. Maybe not in speed, but certainly in track position at that time. I think what he was, you know, several seconds ahead of, you know, probably the next guy on his strategy, one of the yellows, obviously bunched everybody together. I do feel like on speed that we were able to overcut, you know, both him and Ed Jones. You know, so I feel like we managed to, you know, benefit from the start, obviously, on the first corner melee. But also, I don't think you can deny that we did have, you know, good pace, you know, obviously to be the first guy home on the two-stop strategy. So, yeah, it was one of them times where the biggest decision we made probably in the race that was probably off script. We didn't think the red tires were going to last as well as what they did. You know, so our final stint was actually on new reds, where before the race we actually thought it was going to be on new blacks. But that was probably the biggest conversational point during the race that we had.
Gotcha. The one thing that I struggled with, and I admit I have not yet had a chance to go back and watch the race, and was almost kind of found myself playing a little bit of catch up on just kind of how the race was unfolding. You know, I was writing a story probably through most of the first half of the race on just what happened there in lap one, turn one, to get a story out there for folks to give some perspective. And kind of tuned back into the race pretty intently for the latter half. And I was looking back through some of the information that IndyCar gives us on a Slack channel, just to kind of give a little bit of a play-by-play on, you know, who's pitting what lap and who's leading and by how much. But I struggled figuring out truly exactly how Alex and Rossi and Dixon were able to work themselves back up to the front of the field from where they, you know, where they got positioned essentially after that first turn. I know they took three stops, but one of those stops was in yellow flag conditions. So really while that first caution was still going on. So they took two green flag stops, just like you guys. And I don't know if you've watched the race again, or maybe you know enough just kind of understanding how the race played out, because they took their pit stops, their final stops after you guys. And then obviously we're back out ahead. And I just was, if you have any sort of insight on maybe how those guys were still able to work themselves back up to the front, as far as how things played out from a sequencing perspective, that might be good. And maybe you don't, but.
It was the first question I asked when I saw my engineer after the race was how did they get there? Because in all truth, when we came out ahead of Graham, I thought that was to win the race.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously I realized that, you know, those guys were behind us. You know, I mean, before we did before we pit, you know, Alex Ballew was right behind me. And I think that was really just a product of all the yellow flags. And I think essentially they kind of got like a free stop, essentially, yeah. You know, under that yellow, like you said. I don't think it was enough into their fuel window where they thought they could two-stop it any longer. You know, and a lot of people on that strategy had to come in and take service. So, you know, probably just that's probably what helped them the most. Because then they could, as we were able to save fuel and go longer, and that's how I even got past Graham in the first place. So they were able to do the same to me. And then because they did the same, you know, I think their tires were slightly better at the end, you know, and things like that. And obviously what makes a two-stop hard is, you know, obviously trying to keep the tires under you for a long time. And it was the number one question I asked post-race, and what I was confused about. And even my spotter at the time was like, you know, racing Graham here for the win. And I thought we were too, you know, like at that point, I honestly thought that those guys behind either had to make another stop or at minimum on the same strategies as at that point. So watching how fast they were at the end was disappointing for sure. But, you know, again, it kind of was what it was. I think that, you know, the Ganassi cars were, you know, extremely fast. You know, I think Alex actually, he must have topped three out of the four sessions that we even had. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he was quickest in warm in practice, pole, won the race. I mean, sometimes it's your weekend, and clearly, you know, he and his team were doing exceptionally well. So I think it was nice to see him come back from all that melee of turn one and, you know, come back in a strong way. So, you know, and I guess that's why, going back to turn one, I like that it's black and white. But also in that particular day, it would have been extremely harsh for his, you know, championship hopes to have evaporated that way. Luckily, that wasn't the case, and he was able to get another win. I wish they weren't quite that quick at the end, and I wish we were celebrating, you know, a podium for ourselves. But you know, from where we started, I still think that was a great result.
So maybe the best way to put it, as far as those, you know, how those top three guys made it back, they essentially had, they technically made three stops, but you could almost say they essentially had a, also ran a two-stop race, but they had 10 laps less of fuel to try and juggle, and 10 laps less, goodness gracious, on their tires. So when you guys are, they just maybe had to fuel save a little bit less and maybe manage their tires just a little bit less than you guys. And that's probably, it wasn't maybe like one instance that changed the race for them. I guess they, just because of how it played out, the sequencing of everything, they were able to just make that little increment up here and there to be able to work back up ahead of the guys that truly made a two-stop strategy like you guys did over that whole race.
I would say.
Okay, cool. Just hoping to make sure I understood it and give some of our listeners ability to understand that a little bit better, because it was certainly, it did feel like it was one of the more confusing races to figure out how it played out. As you mentioned, you finished fourth. Graham fell back to 10th. I know it was could tell he was, you know, a little bit disappointed from how that race played out. It looked like he, you know, may end up getting his first win in 4 years. Finishes 10th after leading the most laps of the day. That's one of maybe kind of the notable performances that stuck with me that race day. We had Joseph Newgarden, championship contender, finished 5th. I think he was also on the two-stop strategy, if I remember right. Let me take a look here. Yes, he was. So he finished right behind you. Marcus Ericsson finishes 7th, is now 75 points back in the championship hunt. Not mathematically out of it, but certainly you would think 75 points, two races is maybe a little bit much to make up at this point when you've got four people in front of you. I think Joseph is now back 34 or 35 points in third. Dixon is now back, I think, 48 or 49 points in fourth. As I mentioned earlier, he finished 3rd. Pato Ward finishes 14th on the day, a disappointing day for him in the Air McLaren SP squad, though his teammate Felix Rosenquist had his best race of the year, finishing 6th. Pato's now, as I mentioned earlier in the show, back 25 points after going in with a 10-point lead on Alex heading into the weekend. We talked about this a little bit last week. I think, if I remember right, you said, you know, ultimately you probably would like to have the championship lead no matter what internal or external pressures that puts on anyone. I would imagine that you would probably certainly feel the same way as far as, you know, wanting to have Alex's position in the title race if you had to pick with a 25-point gap and just two races to go.
I would say so. You know, he's been so strong from, race one, you know. it's so hard, mate. You know, like, you see in these weekends, like, you know, at Gateway, it looked like he had a good lead, and then he didn't coming out of that week, and then he comes into this one, and it seems like he's reestablished a little bit of a gap, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's the ebb and the flow. I mean, I hate to say the obvious thing, but the guy who's the most consistent in the next two will get it done. Yep. You know, for Alex Palou right now, I mean, it's just the case of trying to balance, I feel like, being aggressive still, you know, but also being kind of calm, you know, and just doing it when it matters. You know, for everyone else, they're very much hunting all the time. And, you know, Alex, if I was him right now, I would feel like my destiny is in my control. You know, for the other guys, if they don't take points out at Laguna Seca, then, you know, you're really going to go into Long Beach just, you know, hoping it falls your way. You know, and actually, I don't I don't know. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what all the different, you know, ramifications are and who has to finish where, you know, heading into the season finale. But I feel like there's a nicer moment knowing that, you know, they probably, you know, the other guys, if we were going into the season finale now, you know, Pato, Scott, Joseph would all be like, well, we have to win and he has to finish below, you know, wherever he does. And I think that's a part of the year that's it's exciting. You know, I think it's always fun to watch from the driver's perspective if anybody's attitude changes or if the way they race changes. And, you know, I think, you know, I know Alex refers to himself as the gorilla, which I must ask him about one time because, I mean, he's one of the nicest guys out there. But, I think, you know, at this point in the season, I think he's going to be, you know, tough to beat. I know the Ganassi guys tested in Laguna at the end of last season. Mm-hmm. You know, and then obviously Long Beach is a bit of a, you know, free-for-all. I'd probably expect Alexander Rossi to be quick in Long Beach. But, I think the last few weekends have really shown how difficult the season is and honestly how you just need to get points all the time. Like, I mean, just DNFs and, you know, finishing, you know, having really terrible finishes for whatever reason, just, you know, kill your season, you know, completely. And just getting to that interesting time of the year, mate, that's all.
Yeah, seems to me, I mean, when you look at Scott in particular, I mean, he certainly probably does have to win both of these races to have a legitimate shot. You know, that automatically gives you a 10-point gap at least on second place. So obviously, if he were to win both those races and Pello were to finish, say, second place in both, then Pello still comes away with it. But when you start looking at, you know, say someone like Joseph or someone like Scott, you know, if they were to win, say one of them go, you know, 1-2 and Alex, I think, you know, say he gets like fifth in both of these races, just to throw out an example. There's a millions of ways of how this can play out still with two races to go. But, you know, I think the fifth place haul in points is like 30. So say, you know, if Joseph were to finish first in one of these races and second in the other, you make up, you know, 20 points in one race and 10 points in the other race. You know, that's 30 points right there. And I think Joseph is somewhere around like 34 points behind. So that gets you almost all the way there. And Alex, I mean, if you were to tell Alex right now, you know, or at least at the end of the year, you have to have two top fives. Do you think, you know, you're leading the championship with two races to go and we'll go ahead and give you two top fives to finish off the year? He might take that, but that's how tight things are, where Joseph and Scott are really going to have monumental weekends to cap the year to have a shot. I think someone like Pato, you know, with 25 points, we've seen multiple times this year how fast 25 points can evaporate, as long as something, you know, weird like a blown engine or crashing out of either of those races doesn't happen between those two guys. I think you are right. I think it really will come down to who has the better weekend better two weekends, I guess, between those two drivers. The point spreads up near the top are so spaced out that, you know, if Pato has, you know, the better average finish out of Laguna and Long Beach, I do think, you know, as long as they're not, you know, both finishing 7th and 10th versus like 6th and 8th or something like that, I think you will probably get your champion from that, unless they both have two very average finishes to the year and Scott or Joseph put some of their veteran championship winning experience to the test. We will have to see. Headed to,
well, so between Joseph and Scott, there's 8 times the champion, right?
Yeah, yes, correct.
They are guys, in my opinion, no matter what is happening, until they are mathematically out of it, you can't write them off. Because if you said to Joseph right now, you've got to win the last two to have a chance at winning the championship, he and Team Penske are the sort of team that you kind of get the feeling they could do that.
I would agree.
The same with Scott Dixon. Mm-hmm. You know, so to me, this title race is very wide open, you know, I would say. I mean, I think Mark has done a great job. You know, there's no doubt about it. But I think, you know, perhaps at this point, it's more a four-horse race, I would say. And mm-hmm. the thing you've got is, you know, you've got two guys who have been through it and they know what they need to do and they know that they have to go to the final few races and win, you know, and perform well. I mean, I've seen Scott has to have a perfect weekend, you know, before and still win the championship. And it was on a tiebreaker. You know, you talk about having to deal with the pressure of having a perfect weekend. And these are guys who not only can they deal with it, they've done it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you are not safe. You know, when Scott and Joseph are still in the hunt, mathematically, you are not safe. And weirder things have happened. And of two guys who you kind of just get in the sense in your belly that could do it if the opportunity were there, Scott and Joseph are probably the two guys at the start of the year that you look at and just say, you just got a feeling they might do it.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about Joseph last year. I don't remember the exact points deficit that he had to Dixon after that first race at Gateway that Scott won, if memory serves me right. Scott, I mean, I think it was maybe somewhere upwards of like 120 points even. And Joseph goes over the last six races of the year, first place, second place, eighth place, first place, fourth place, first place. And he, if Scott had not finished, I can't remember exactly where Dixon finished at St. Pete last year in the finale. Now I've got it. So he finished third place. So Joseph made up somewhere like 16 or 17 points, and I think cut into like half of what Dixon's lead was. If Dixon finishes sixth or seventh at St. Pete last year with Joseph winning, I think Joseph comes away with that championship. So I would agree with you on that front. I wonder, I mean, the only reason I question Scott, and certainly I would agree with you, he's absolutely in this championship until he's mathematically not. He has seemed like he's just never quite had the full, you know, Scott Dixon dominant part of even any part of this season that we would typically expect out of the years in which he has won a championship. And that's the only reason why I wonder if this is the year for him. He even told me a little bit when I spoke with him for a couple minutes after Sunday's race that he's almost gotten to the point where, you know, if he needs to kind of change roles to make sure and ensure that someone on Ganassi, meaning Alex, obviously wins this championship, that he's certainly ready to assist in that. I imagine that that probably wouldn't really happen until Long Beach if he's, you know, still 50 or whatever points out. If he maintains this gap to Alex, I imagine, you know, maybe he switches gears a little bit. But you're right. You know, if he goes and wins at Laguna and he's 30 points back, just like Joseph was last year heading into the finale, I think you can absolutely bet that Scott is still trying to pull off this championship until he's told by Mike Hull to kind of just help put people behind Alex to help him protect
his. And what was interesting watching that race back, I didn't realize that those two guys had come together, and I've never raced for Chip Ganassi, but I do hear, like, the first thing is you don't crash into your teammates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and not saying that was not Scott's fault, especially when you watch it back, but I mean, I bet there was more than a few people within that organization who were probably a little stressed out on Sunday. So I think they're pretty good about letting the drivers just race and race fairly and things like that. But the overwhelming moment and point will come is you don't crash into your teammate.
Mm-hmm.
So I personally just can't. I mean, I could totally see it because he's a very nice guy and, you know, he's an absolute pro and had a ton of success himself. But I just get the sense that Scott's going to have one of them weekends that he needs in Laguna, you know, to keep himself firmly in the championship race.
Yep. Let's look. He finished third place there a couple years ago in 2019 and IndyCar's first visit there in quite some time. I'm not sure if he had raced there earlier in his career during either the early IndyCar days or the kart days, so you've got something like that. I think Joseph, someone mentioned, has finished second there. Maybe it was second at the last time we, yeah, it was second the last time we were at Long Beach. So he's got something there. It'll be exciting. I think certainly, barring something really freaky happening, I don't think we will be done talking about who has to finish where to win the championship. I think this is going to be just even more of a hotter topic once we get past Sunday at WeatherTech Raceway, Laguna Seca. Let's switch gears a little bit. Talk a little bit about this race that we have upcoming. I know IndyCar's only raced there once in recent years. You know, we heard about the switch heading into 2019, and then we got there in 19 and weren't able to get back there last year. So this is really only the second time the series has been there in quite some time. What can you tell us about what we can expect from Sunday's race that will air at roughly 3 p.m. Eastern on NBC? You still there, Jack?
Yes, mate.
Okay, yeah, I just was
Sorry,
saying.
I got time for a second there.
No, you're good.
I heard you the whole time.
What can you tell us about this track that we're heading to next year at Laguna?
I think it's, I would say Laguna probably is this low grip, permanence road course that we go to. I think it typically has been extremely high degradation. Kind of outside of that, it's kind of one of them tracks I feel like we haven't really been to a ton to really know how the race is going to be, other than we know it's low grip and tire degradation is quite strong. We haven't started, our prep yet. A lot of the guys on the team did a red eye back, so then he got home yesterday morning, and then obviously today is Tuesday, so they're now just getting to work probably on Laguna. So it may be a smidge early in the week to know exactly what we're getting into. But I think, Laguna is one of them tracks, right? If you're a bit of a motorsport fan, you've heard of Laguna Seca. You for sure know about the corkscrew. And it's just an iconic racetrack, iconic racing corner. And, I know everyone at the NTT IndyCar Series is excited to go. I hope that there's a good crowd. And honestly, I think we were all a little nervous that some of these West Coast races, may not have actually happened. So, very, very thankful to everyone who managed to keep that on the straight and narrow, make sure that we could, and then get through Laguna straight to Long Beach. And then that'll be the season done. So immense amount of work right now. And I mean, I know you're busy as well. Everyone's kind of in that busy, end of season, last push phase as it goes. But I think Laguna will be an interesting race. I actually think one of the most difficult things at Laguna is actually getting in and out of pit lane. Coming into pit lane, is an extremely tight left-hand hairpin. The first pit box sucks there because you haven't even really had a chance to re-accelerate. And then also coming out of pit lane in turn one is, pretty snug, and obviously you're trying to push as hard as you can without going off the track, because if you fall off the track there, you end up coming out in the middle of turn one. So I think Laguna's got a lot of interesting things about it, but I hope we just have a smooth weekend, honestly.
Is there, as a natural terrain permanent road course, I know IndyCar races on several of those, as someone like me who's never been there before, is it anything like, any portions of, say, Barber or Mid-Ohio or Road America, anything that you can, liken it to at all? Or is it really, truly a very unique course on its own from that standpoint?
There's a huge amount of elevation change, and I think that's pretty cool to see. So maybe similar to Road America in that sense. In terms of how the track actually drives, the grip of the track and stuff like that, I mean, I feel like some street circuits have more grip than Laguna does. I feel like St. Pete's a grippier track, once the rubber gets going and down on it. It's pretty iconic. It's just kind of its own little thing, and I think that's what makes you know, Laguna, such a cool, you know, track and a cool venue. Obviously, and I think a lot of people like to be in Monterey. You know, when the season finished there a few years ago, me and my parents, you know, stayed out and, you know, enjoyed a lot of the activities that are around that area. So, yeah, I think it's very much just its own, its own thing, I guess. You know, it's very unique.
Yeah, its own beast, you might say. Well, let's dig into a couple of these questions we got from folks on Twitter before we end this week's episode. We've talked through some of them a little bit, but we'll go through and hit ones that we haven't already talked about a good amount. Let's see here. Start things off with Duncan Idaho 11. We touched on this a little bit already, but he asks, is there palpable fear going into turn one at Portland, and how bananas is it compared to other tracks?
Well, yeah, I kind of feel like we covered this earlier. I definitely think there's something difficult about Portland turn one. I mean, it's extremely quick. You know, I mean, your top speed of the track, I think, is nearly there, you know, into a first gear 90 degree right-hander, you know, and the difference even between there and, let's say, Indy, which is, you know, if you look at the track map, a similar-ish kind of layout for turn one and two. It's even more condensed and it's wide, gets very narrow. You know, it's a tough one. I think, you know, the drivers normally have to do their part in trying to make sure that, you know, we as drivers don't crash into each other and stuff like that, really. So, it's getting through turn one is an absolute priority all the time.
All right. From Tire Guy's Wife 16, she asks, how good does it feel to finally have all of your extraordinary effort pay off? I've been following your journey since 2017, and I'm inspired by your drive and determination. How hard is it to keep grinding when trying to get going and stay positive with your eye on the prize? Hashtag go, Jack, go.
That side of my life is easy, honestly. You know, I will never, ever forget the pain and the disappointment and the frustrations of sitting out races. You know, even when we were partial seasons, before we even had a partial season, you know, drive even. So for me, it's super easy to stay positive about anything like that because I love what I do. You know, I feel exceptionally grateful to be able to do it. And yeah, I mean, that side of life is super easy. You know, and it's definitely not hard to stay positive. I love my life. I love what I do. You know, we've certainly had some bad results this year, which are disappointing. And obviously would have rather have not have had them or gone through them. But yeah, I think, you know, me may leave Sunday a bit disappointed, but certainly, you know, by Tuesday morning, you know, I'm back in the gym. I was in the gym this morning already, you know, pushing on, trying to make as many gains as we can, just because I think that's what IndyCar, you know, requires. And to be competitive in the series is what you need. So it's an easy one to stay on top of.
Indy Fanatics writes, getting ahead of Graham was vital on that last pit stop sequence as you end up P4. Graham fell away to P10. How difficult was it to keep him behind you coming out of the pits, or did your stick of red tires make it fairly comfortable?
I was a little surprised how much grip I got from them so quickly, which was particularly important coming, you know, through the last, you know, three corners there, you know, kind of came out. I thought that maybe he was going to try and make a move into turn seven, but I think I was just enough ahead to keep it covered. And then obviously, you know, spent some push to pass to try and make sure that he couldn't do anything into turn 10. And, you know, as soon as I got through turn 12, I realized that we had gone, you know, so it was a critical part of the race. I think if we hadn't managed to get past him there, it would have been, you know, difficult to have. Probably, I feel like if we hadn't got past him there, I think we would have probably ended up like seventh. I think it would have been like a sixth or seventh, maybe. You know, it would have been probably a fair end result for us. So that pit sequence was extremely critical. We didn't have a great in because I had to come around you know, Takuma, because he was coming into the pits too. And yeah, the way that all played out, our inlet was mega, outlet was mega, and yeah, it just ended up working out really nicely for us.
Question here from Alan asks, says, great drive, Jack. What would have had to change in the race that would have made your strategy and drive potential for a race win at Portland?
What I think would have needed, honestly, probably at that moment, just didn't need that yellow. Probably needed them to be more forced into having to, you know, stop for a traditional three stopper, let's say, instead of, you know, being able to overcut us and then, you know, have to fuel again. You know, I think in the same breath where it was advantageous, as it brought Graham back to us, and, you know, the amount that we were able to catch up to him in our overcut and our final pit stop sequence was probably not as much as the gap that he actually had on track with us. So without talking to the team and really dialing into it, I'm not entirely sure what extra we needed. We probably needed, you know, one of the Ganassi guys or Rossi to have a bad pit stop, you know, or something to have promoted us to the podium, you know, which obviously didn't happen. So, yeah, I think in the end, you know, it was finishing P4 was probably a pretty fair reflection of our day and our strategy.
Dan Maldonado asks, have you finally gone to a Wendy's?
I haven't. No, I haven't. I don't know what it is. I'm not even sure, like, what Wendy's is famous for. Is it, like, burgers? Is it, like, I don't know.
They've got a good, I guess you would call it, like, a milkshake. They call it a Frosty.
Ooh.
So those are really good, you know, vanilla or chocolate, one of those is probably my favorite thing to get there. I will admit it's not like a place that I, you know, if I'm really wanting, which I mean, is not really that often, but if I'm like, you know, on a road trip and needing to stop somewhere and just get some fast food, or, you know, it's a late night and I've just got to go and get some food to eat, you know, Wendy's is probably not a place I'm like, for me, I'm like actively seeking out. I mean, it's the fries aren't, you know, the fries are fine. Their burgers are fine. It's certainly not something that, you know, I think they're, you know, on the upper echelon of fast food. So I guess I would be there with you. But if you really needed to have it sometime, I would get just get a Frosty. And you could probably, that's probably the best thing you could get there. So just my two cents.
Yeah, because I guess to me, if someone's like, hey, let's get a burger, like, I'd probably go to McDonald's.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
You know, and if I'm going for like fries and I only want fries, I'm probably going to Arby's because I really like their curly fries.
Good.
If you want like I love Chick-fil-A, you know. So I don't know, I guess Wendy's to me like is not my first choice burger, and that's what I kind of see it as being.
Yeah, don't disagree with you there. We've got a question here from Ben Lamb asks, does Jack like pork tenderloin sandwiches yet? And if so, which restaurant do you like the best?
And this is going to offend a lot of people, especially in Indiana. I feel like I don't know if I've ever really had a pork tenderloin sandwich.
That's fair. I'll be honest. I have not, as a person who grew up in Indiana, still lives there, I don't know that I've been to too many restaurants specifically that have made a good pork tenderloin sandwich. There are a couple, and I feel bad now with the question not being able to come up with them off the top of the head and give them some love. But typically, pork tenderloin sandwich is something that I feel like a state fair type place does well. I had one at the Indiana State Fair a month or so ago. So I almost feel like that's a better place to get one than like an actual restaurant, mostly because the weird thing about a pork tenderloin sandwich is part of the thing is that the sandwich itself is like seven times as big as the bun. And most restaurants are going to give you a sandwich that's like, you know, a little bit bigger, but, you know, certainly a lot closer to like a typical burger patty or a chicken sandwich patty than the reason I guess a pork tenderloin is famous for. Sandwich is great if you can find it at a good place, but I don't know that there are too many actual sit down restaurants that you can get a good one. So in that point, I don't necessarily blame you.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I've seen people order them, and again, I'm not trying to be offensive. It just doesn't jump at me as like, oh my god, I've really got to try that.
Yeah, I think that's
fair. It looks like it needs a lot of ketchup and a lot of mayo.
That is a fair point, definitely. Doberman 225 asks, what will you miss the most when you do leave Meyershank Racing at the end of the year?
Oh, so many things. You know, honestly, I mean, we did this journey all together, you know, and I know so many of the guys there, you know, maybe not like super intimately, but I know a lot of, their life away from the track, you know, I know their wives' names, their kids' names, you know, girlfriend names and all that. And, you know, the thing that people need to remember is, you know, I've been at MSR now, quite a long time. And, you know, making that decision to leave wasn't an easy one. You know, in the same breath, I still feel like it is the right one to do. And, you know, I'm going to miss the people. You know, I miss a lot of them guys I know really well, hang out with, you know, stay over to each other's houses, things like that. You know, I'll probably miss some of the partners that we have, you know, grown together with as well. But, to pinpoint one specific thing, no, I would say that's probably, you know, quite hard. But, I'm excited. I'm more excited about what's coming in all fairness than, perhaps what we, you know, won't have anymore.
Mm-hmm. Darpo on Twitter asked the question, and I will read it, and I know that you can't answer it, but I'm going to read it anyways, because I know we're all wondering. Who are you driving for in 2022?
I will announce that at the appropriate time.
There we go. And a final question, semi-related, from Jack Marrows asks, are you confident a win or a podium can happen with your new team next season? And he asks a separate, unrelated part to that question. Can you bring a car over and give it a spin around our hometown, Lincoln, England?
Nothing would make me happier than taking an Indy car through my hometown. That would be like a bucket list item for me. So of that, if there's ever the opportunity to do it, I will do it in a heartbeat. I will fly over there. I would love every moment of it. You know, to share that with my hometown would be incredible. I mean, honestly, the goal where we're going is to try and win races, you know, podium regularly, and try and have a push to win the championship. It's, something we're working hard to, try and do with them. I know they're going to try and work hard to do it with me. And, you know, they've shown a lot of faith and support in wanting me to be their new driver. And I think people forget it would have been an extremely easy decision for me just to have stayed where it was comfortable or safe. We didn't do that. I felt like it was the right time to make a step. And, where I'm going next, I believe, is that place where I can also elevate myself from going and being, you know, on the fringe of the podium to being, you know, on the podium and put together, you know, across the whole season, consistent results. Because, you know, as I've said, I think that the potential of everyone at Meyershank Racing is very high, you know, and certainly we've shown great speed a lot of times and things like that. We just haven't done it on a consistent basis. And, you know, that's what we're trying to achieve. But I mean, the goals and aspirations that, you know, I have for next year are, you know, 100% matched by the team. So, I'm absolutely confident that we can score race wins and podiums.
There you have it. All right, a quick rundown of this weekend's schedule. First practice on Friday at 5:30 Eastern. That's 2:30 local in California. Second practice at 1:45 Eastern, 45-minute sessions for you guys. We've got Firestone Fast 6 qualifying from 5 o'clock until 6:20 Eastern time on Saturday. You guys can do the math if you are out in the West Coast. And then of course Sunday got another 3 p.m. start for folks there in Indiana or on the East Coast. That's noon local time in Monterey, California at WeatherTech Raceway, Laguna Seca. This race again on Big NBC for the second consecutive weekend before we finish things up on NBC Sports on September 26th for the Acura Grand Prix of Long Beach. That's it for this week's edition of IndyCar Weekly. Thanks for all of you who submitted questions this week. Be sure to send more of those in as this season comes to a close, and we will tackle even more next week on next week's episode. Thanks, as always, for joining me, Jack, and best of luck to the number 60 squad here as you guys gear up for Monterey.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks again for listening, and catch us next week for the next edition of IndyCar Weekly. I'm Nathan Brown. Thanks for listening.